Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida, led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu. Hey, all, today we have a special treat. We're going back to the archives of November 2020 when Dr. Laura Janssens and Pete Janssens welcomed Dr. Skip Wrenn on the show for the first time. Hope you all enjoy. See you guys next week.
Me, sure. I'm ready.
Okay. 1, 2, 3.
Okay. Welcome, everybody, to NeuroNoodles Podcast featuring Dr. Laura Janssens. Hi, Dr. Laura.
Hello, Pete.
Okay. Hello, Pete. Hi, I'm Pete Janssens, owner of NeuroNoodle, co-host of the podcast. Dr. Laura is the co-host as well. We have a special guest today, Dr. Skip Wrenn. Wrenn, did I say that right, Doc? Wrenn.
Pretty close.
I need some more neurofeedback. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Skip. We're going to call you Dr. Skip from now on. Is that okay?
That's perfect. It's easier for everybody, and I'll answer to it.
That's fantastic. The topic is listener questions that we got from our last podcast, and a majority of them are dealing with kids and COVID. How parents should work with their kids on the topic. I'll be reading off the questions, and you guys can answer. I will stay back. Once it's done, you guys let me know you're done, and I'll read off another question. Dr. Skip, tell us about yourself before we get going.
Sure.
How do we find you?
Thanks for having me on, first of all. And then to answer that last question, I have been in psychology for 25 years, but in 2012 or so, I switched up and started studying neuropsychology, which took me to Chicago to study with Len Koziel. And that's how I met Dr. Janssens at that course or course of study. It was a couple years. And so we overlapped a year and we got to know each other and have kept in touch and consulted. And whenever I have a question, she's the first person to call, probably because she takes my call, but she knows a lot too. So that helps. And again, we've just kind of kept in touch over the years. And I think probably most importantly, because there's other peers that I consult with, is I think we share a sensibility about this work. And it's probably directly related to our mentor, Len Koziel.
Well, he gets the ultimate shout out. Rest in peace, right?
Yeah, Len knew some stuff, that's for sure. He was a neuroscientist trapped in a neuropsychologist's body.
And Dr. Laura, can you tell us about yourself as well for all the new parents that have come on board?
Sure. I am also, identify myself as a neuropsychologist at this point in my career. Been working about the same quantity of time as Dr. Skip here. 25, 30 years in the business. I started off, I went to Bradley University, and I don't know if I'm unusual, but I still keep in contact with my college mentor and college friends. And I go back to, it was Bradley University. I go back there frequently, you know, meeting friends and mentors. One of my mentors, we talked about this in the last podcast, is in addition to Len Koziel, is Dr. Lori Russell, and she's written one of the best textbook in neurofeedback. So anyway, I went to Bradley. I have strong connections there still. She has a center for brain research, and you know, can I participate with that group? They have yearly conferences, and they invite people there like PTSD specialists, Dr. Vander Kolk, and other Dr. Amen, and you know, other people in the field who are pretty prominent. So anyway, I like to keep looped up into that. Making the introduction longer than it needs to, my earlier career was in doing psychotherapy, which is, you know, the talk therapy, helping people change, you know, consciously change their thinking systems so that their moods and their situations improve. And along the way, met Dr. Koziel, Len Koziel. We just by accident, actually, he was renting space in the same place. He turned me on to neuropsychology, and off that ran. It was actually Skip. I was thinking about this morning, Skip. I believe it was Skip who kind of turned me back on to neurofeedback. I've certainly heard about it, and Dr. Russell's definitely kind of lit some flames for me with that. But I think it was Skip who he might have to correct me on this, but I think he's the one who kind of called or contacted me and said, hey, this neurofeedback training, you want to do it? And I think I gave him my usual response without thinking, yeah, sure, why not? And we both got in the neurofeedback as a supplement to our neuropsych testing. So long answer, there you go.
And neurofeedback, I mean, it's been around a while, at least since the early 90s. I mean, it's been around longer than that, but I mean, really got going then. Is that right? Because you guys combined your experience, shoot, that's 50 years.
Plus, 50 yeah, years. We can do a history class and talk about, you know, isolating neurons and isolating an alpha wave. That was in the late 1800s. So this stuff has been around for a long time.
Sure it has. And biofeedback predates neurofeedback, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Okay, guys, a couple quick shout, thanks for doing that. A couple quick shout outs. Robert Thatcher, do you guys know him?
Yes.
He owns my mortgage.
NeuroGuide Z-Score database. You know, he's the one that has the big database, the normative database that we compare our brain scans to. Is that right, guys?
Yeah, that's correct.
But president and CEO of Applied Neuroscience Incorporated, definitely deserves a shout out. And then John, is it Demos, right? Demos. No, we'll edit that out in post. Yeah. John Demos. Okay. Got a book that I probably bought a few, no matter how I pronounce it. I know I've bought several of his books for the business, Getting Started with EEG Neurofeedback. It's a must own. So shout out, great work. You guys got anything to add to those two guys?
For Bob Thatcher, the NeuroGuide software system that he's basically developed that complements or maybe even rests on the database you were referring to, I see it in all kinds of other practitioners' work. And as they start talking about EEGs, brainwave activity, and things like that, they're referring to and showing pictures of NeuroGuide. And so it's a pretty prominent software program that I can speak for myself, certainly, but allows us to do some pretty innovative things that weren't available even back in the 90s, early 2000s. Like, we can see stuff now that we just couldn't in our offices, right? Mm-hmm. That's pretty phenomenal.
Well, you know, the parents that I've seen, they want to see a difference in what's going on with their kids. And it's easy to to explain red and green, right?
Yeah.
Very easy. Okay. Okay. Shout outs are done. Oh man, we got a bunch of questions, and just to let everybody know, we don't have enough time to get to get into the weeds of everything. We're going to come in at 30,000 feet. And then based on the response that we get from the podcast, we'll narrow down and we'll have another podcast on what everybody's commenting on. What do you guys think?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, we talk about this stuff forever, you know?
Oh, yeah. We will. We will. Well, just not today. Just not today. Okay. The first one I have on the list, Dr. Skip, is, you know, how does anxiety impact development?
Well, immensely is the short kind of smart alecky answer, right? But real quick, maybe we can just define what anxiety is, because I think people have a general idea. And there's certainly, as with any disorder, a spectrum that you fall on as far as intensity of symptoms and so forth. But anxiety is basically a stress that's out of proportion to whatever the event or situation might be, right? It leads to worry, restlessness. Sometimes there's preemptive worry and restlessness about potential future events, right? Some of the cognitive side effects can be, or symptoms, or lack of concentration, racing thoughts, unwanted thoughts is a big one, right? You don't want to be worrying about stuff, but there it is. And these kind of cognitive and kind of tangible symptoms that I'm referring to have physiological effects that then now everybody's involved. So now you got mind, body, and spirit playing. And now you're feeling nervousness. Now you're sweating. Now your heart's racing, which is a loop. And so now your consciousness recognizes, oh my gosh, my heart's racing. What's the matter? Any thought like that's going to startle the fight or flight system. And now your unconscious autonomic nervous systems at play, and now everybody's on board. And so anxiety can be a debilitating disorder, if you will, but again, just to kind of lay out what it is, and it can be extreme, it can be minor, but it's often debilitating when it's around. So it affects development, right? It affects performance just by its mere presence.
Okay, Dr. Laura, what do you think? How does it impact the kid's development? Parents want to know. Besides wasted energy, right? Pardon the pun.
Well, yeah, your resources are going toward defending yourself. I mean, I think in terms of evolution, you know, everyone has heard, you can Google all the, you know, parts of the nervous system. But, you know, for play at home neuroscience bingo, we have an amygdala in our brain. And it's responsible for fight or flight. You know, you back an organism into the corner. It's got, you know, two options to, you know, run away or beat something up. And we kind of know that catchphrase, you know, if we don't, you know, we're not biology or, you know, psychology majors, we've heard the phrase fight or flight. What we may not be as knowledgeable about is the third option. If you stump an organism, they cannot fly, they cannot fight. The other option is freeze. And so there's a whole set of symptoms involved in this freeze mechanism. You know, it's a defense response when you're trapped. And, you know, as we're thinking about COVID and you know, I'm going to date this podcast, but, you know, we're waiting on an election right now. And we don't need to go down that road at all, except to say that we're kind of in freeze. Like we don't know where we're going, what's going to happen next. And you know, there's a whole set of things going on with that. With COVID, you know, you're at home. You know, you don't know, you know, if your class is going to meet next week. And if we're talking about kids. And there's this kind of limbo, you know, situation that people are in, you know, in terms of anxiety. So, you know, we definitely have the physiological symptoms, you know, heart racing, you know, get into the vagus nerve. And, you know, again, put that on your bingo card. But vagus nerve has to do with your, you know, intestine functioning. I'm sure Skip can talk about, you know, chronic anxiety and toxicity with chemicals and how they affect your gut and how your gut and your anxiety is connected. So, you know, there's many, many things happening. But, you know, I think we should pay special attention during COVID here with this freeze response with, you know, dissociative effects or low. I see so many patients. I'm seeing a lot of patients still, and, you know, we're doing all the precautions, but I'm seeing a lot of this real low motivation, low inertia, low energy, this kind of withdrawal kind of effect, withdrawing from society, even though we're already, you know, kind of trapped a little bit. But yeah, you get this kind of low arousal response, and it's a freeze. It's a freeze response to anxiety. And that's something that is, you know, more subtle and, you know, less understood maybe. And I think we need to put a spotlight on that. And, you know, when we talk about anxiety.
Last week, we gave a shout out to Seaburn Fisher, and she wrote a book that talked about developmental psychology. And I don't want to get too into the weeds of that, but you guys are the docs. I'm not. I'm just reading a book. But isn't there an age where for the kids and their development that whatever's happening to them now, if they're anxious now, it might set the path for them to be anxious later in life? Can you speak to that?
Well, sure, I can, Pete. I think that there's truth to that. That's the nature of development, in that we respond to our environment. So the old joke is, hey, is it nature or nurture? And the answer is yeah, because you are set up with your genetics. That can be turned on and turned off as well, which is another podcast. But your environment has a direct impact on development. And so, yes, these things send you on a path. Ironically, one of the subtext of your podcast is neurofeedback, which neurofeedback is phenomenal for setting things on other paths or more prescribed paths if we're going to start getting into brainwave frequencies and ranges and such. But anyway, so there are ages where maybe it's more impactful. Everybody that's, you know, speaking on this podcast is in a different state developmentally than, say, a five-year-old. I think the same principles would apply to us, in that if we experience something in our environment, it would affect our future development, because we still got some time left, if you know what I'm saying. But we're here to talk about kids. I think what I would like to say about the development piece, and I'll just give my kind of opinion in my work, and Laura and Pete, it feels like a big thrust of my communication with parents is having the conversation around this development or influence of factors on unconscious functioning. And so the development that you're referring to, Pete, as you know, is unconscious functioning, right? It's the 95% of the things that the brain and body do beyond our conscious awareness. And we need it to be that way, or we'd never get out the door in the morning, right? But to have the conversation with parents so that they can comprehend, understand, maybe even carry it into live events in their life, is that, hey, yeah, your kid's exhibiting these symptoms and we can see them, but they're driven by factors beyond your son or daughter's consciousness. If that weren't the case, it's as simple as this. You would say, hey, Johnny or Janie, stop being anxious. And they'd say, you know what? That's a great idea. Thanks. But it doesn't work that way. So roundabout way, Pete, of saying, yeah, development happens and it sets folks on trajectories and then habits form over time, physiologically and neurologically. And then that becomes our go-to, right? That's our fixed, in quotes, personality. What we know now, even since Laura and I started in school in the last 15 years or so, so much has come out with the advent of technologies. Now that we can see things, Laura and I have incredible technologies in our offices, right? Because of things being available that weren't even 20 years ago. It's changed our ideas about how things are set. And so things can change, is my point.
Well, just to kind of, you know, kind of go to the left hand of that in, I think in terms of, and this is Len's fault, you know, I think in terms of neuroanatomy or brain structures, how, you know, how the, you know, what's under the engine, you know, and we know, or we say we know, that there, when you hit back to the fight or flight response, we know when there's fear, when there is trauma, and I think we can use the word trauma with, you know, back to talking about COVID, talking about children, talking about the environment we're under. I mean, we all, you know, can bounce back. We're, you know, we use the word plastic, that we can learn to adapt, and that's a Len Koziel thing for sure. You know, we can learn to adapt to our situation, but, you know, what we know about how the brain operates, that many of the structures in the brain are plastic, and which means you can mold the brain structures with learning. So, you know, there's that quote, neurons that fire together, wire together. So meaning you can learn things, and that actually changes the structure of your brain. There's a study, actually Seaburn Fisher brought this up in her book, study of some cab drivers. And they took pictures of the brain beforehand, and they trained these cab drivers in different routes, like driving different places, and they had to memorize these different routes. And they took pictures afterwards, and they saw that these parts of the brain, these deep structures, hippocampi, the deep structures in the brain that consolidate memory, they actually physically were different after the learning experience. So point is that, yeah, you know, we can learn, we can adapt, we're plastic, but here's the problem. And I think when we talk about anxiety, is that the deeper the brain structure, the older the part of the brain, the more primitive the part of the brain, the less plastic it is. So where I'm going with that is that when you have a, you know, extreme fight or flight reaction, and you're living in fight or flight, or you're, you know, in this limbo of freeze and all that kind of stuff, those parts aren't very plastic. And, you know, while we can, you know, again, learn routes, and we, you know, our brains are phenomenal, you know, in terms of learning different procedures and adapting and all the good stuff, the issue seems to come down to, you know, if you're traumatized, kind of what does that do, and how can you learn, how can you do anything but try to survive? And that's where our resources are going. And I think that becomes the issue. So I think we're, me and Skip are absolutely on the same page with, yeah, we can adapt to things. And Len Koziel really brought that to our attention. And we're capable of adapting to zillions of things. But when you have fear involved, that kind of, you know, shuts the dials down.
That goes into the next question, guys. And maybe you covered it, maybe you didn't, but how does anxiety affect learning or IQ? Mom wants to know.
I'll handle, or at least I'll address the learning. And my experience of working with folks with any kind of emotional addition to the environment, meaning if you're engaged in a problem-solving task, and as the evaluator, I'm evaluating, meaning I'm timing and counting what's happening. Anytime an emotion is introduced to that setting, it confounds the problem-solving process. What does that mean? It's simple language. When you have emotions riding shotgun with you, they're going to mess up your problem-solving strategies. So the issue that I always try to address with parents is what we're talking about, or what we're referring to in general, right? Obviously, specifics exist. But in general, we're talking about an emotional dysregulation. Back to this idea of anxiety and certainly trauma, these things are adaptions to our environment. And because of the way we operate as you know, mammals, is it becomes a physiological and neurological response system. It's automatic, right? So when you have these things that are automatic and that are there, even something which Laura and I, old hats here, would say, what's the big deal? We're just doing some testing. Folks get anxious when they test. And if you have difficulties with emotional regulation, some folks do, a lot of folks I do, but any that I see do. But if you have that kind of automatic response, then the anxiety is introduced into the setting, again, unconsciously. It's a response to its environment because it's learned and habituated. And so you can then see, hopefully, by the way I'm describing it, how that would impact the specific testing environment, right? Or learning environment, right? What I do with folks is evaluate. But that then will compile. And if you're constantly, again, having an emotion riding shotgun that's kind of confounding the process of learning, it's going to take its toll cumulatively over time. And so that's the longer answer. The shorter answer is that it's going to interfere with learning. It has to, by definition, because it's there and it requires space. Right. And then it's going to have its effects on its own. And so that's, you know, with anxiety or trauma or depression, any kind of emotional addition to a problem solving strategy is going to make it more difficult, right?
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida. They're led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Our Love and Loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Huarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.
Think of any horror movie when someone's trying to, you know, grab their keys and open up the front door because something's chasing them, right? Like they're all freaked out and they can't even remember which keys for the front door.
That's a difficult one because, you know, we're trying to define IQ and what's the purpose of an IQ test, and we can get into all sorts of debates about that. But I think the question probably just kind of boils down to, you know, back to the adaptability. You know, maybe, you know, if we boil down what is an IQ, you know, it's how can you function in the real world. And, you know, again, we go back to trauma, go back to anxiety. You know, what Skip was just referring to in the, you know, questions about learning, and again, I'm going to go under the hood here with talking about some brain structures, but amygdala's fight or flight, we know that stuff. That is part of what's called the limbic system. It's the emotional system, but what's important to know is not the terms, and that, you know, again, trying to give you a science class here, as much as to tell you this part, that the amygdala, which is your fight or flight, your anxiety defense mechanism, is directly involved with your memory systems. So, you know, learning anxiety move together. So if you're relaxed, you're going to learn. If you're not relaxed, forget it. And I guess we are talking about unconscious learning here. You know, even, there's this tradition. I talked to a gentleman once from the country of India, and he talked about this concept called punch the pillow. And I thought it just kind of sticks in my mind. He said in their country, and I don't know, you know, what parts of the country, whatever, but he said before they go to bed at night, they're trained, or, you know, the part of the tradition, to punch the pillow. He said, what's punch the pillow? What's that? When you're ready to fall asleep, you go into, you're part awake, part asleep, and that's where we learn the best. So when we're most relaxed, we learn the best. So he punches the pillow with an intention, something he wants to remember the next day. And so he'll say, oh, I have to remember to pick up my laundry or go to this meeting or finish this report or whatever he's working on. And he punches the pillow. And then in that relaxed state, the memory sticks. So, you know, so it kind of speaks to the same, you know, question of learning and memory, even at this unconscious level. And Skip, you know, said the same thing, that we're only learning when we're relaxed. So, you know, what resources do we have available, you know, to put toward, you know, the blackboard, but toward the screen when you're doing the Zoom learning and all the anxiety that creates if you're not relaxed. So they absolutely go hand in hand.
What's the difference between anxiety and ADHD? A dad wants to know.
I can answer my way, and then I'm kind of liking the way you're going under the hood, so to speak, Laura. But so real quick, and again, not to turn this into any kind of, any 101 whatever for anybody necessarily, but you have to know about the diagnostic protocol. You don't have to, but it's just, I think it's helpful to understand it, that things like anxiety, ADHD, autism, depression, they're labels, and we know that, and it's the nomenclature for the mental health and psychiatric world, so that issues can be communicated back and forth between providers and let's not forget insurance companies and humans, right? Other people. So that's there. But what they represent are observable physical behaviors that then fit a certain criteria, 6 out of 8, 8 out of 10, whatever, that would then qualify someone for a certain diagnosis. Now, why I'm mentioning all this is because there's an incredible amount of overlap, and everybody on this podcast right now could probably qualify for 40 or 50 diagnoses today because they're so generic sometimes. And I might be just speaking for me, but might be a little more generic in their application, meaning there's overlap of observable symptoms between both ADHD and anxiety. And so that's where when Laura gets a second here, she can talk about more where they come from neurologically, but also it need be mentioned that the DSM doesn't necessarily tie these diagnoses to neurological functioning. They're observable behaviors, things we can see, right? And I think it's an important distinction. They're not something that live in a petri dish, right? It's something that we've agreed to call things. And so with that said, again, anxiety tends to be worry, hypervigilance, intrusive thoughts. It has physical manifestations of heart palpitations and sweating and, you know, things along those lines. Whereas ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is what that acronym is for, tends to refer to difficulty paying attention to things, difficulty staying still, right? That's the activity part. So it's more of a dis or inattention to things, as well as a difficulty or even inability to not do things. So if you want to think, the way I always think of it is you think those Western saloon doors, and you have a part of your brain that Laura can talk about that swings one way and the other way, and it allows you to do things or not do things, or not start things and start things. So you're continually monitoring your environment and doing what's appropriate. And if your gating system or your saloon doors aren't working okay, then that results in often what's referred to as the ADHD, you know, diagnoses. But there's overlap is my point. So this dad wants to know what the difference is. And there is a difference, but they could be the same thing in sheep's clothing on different days, given their neural anatomy sources. And with that, I'll kind of defer to Laura if she's okay to take over from there. But
sure. Yeah, I like your saloon door analogy. What first came to my mind, though, is what Len Koziel had said. You know, we Len Koziel in our classes, you know, talk frequently about the DSM and how a diagnostic statistical manual, it's the Bible, so to speak, that psychiatry uses to label people, you know, give diagnosis so that they can, you know which direction to go with their treatment. But so, you know, the conversation of DSM came up quite a bit, and especially as Skip mentioned that, you know, you open up one of these manuals that have all these symptoms in there, and there's very little, we'll say, objective information there. There's very little, if any, talk about neurology and neuropsychology and objective testing, and I could probably bet the license that there's nothing in there about neurofeedback. So it's a very subjective tools, and Len would argue, even from, you know, where he's at right now, that it's outdated, and we have other ways of, you know, understanding people and you know, helping them develop treatments and things. But back to Len. So I remember what he said in class that, you know, ADHD used to be called, they used to have two branches back, I think, in the 80s when I first started. It was ADD and ADHD. Remember that, Skip? They had ADD. So it used to be attention deficit disorder, and then it used to be attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity. So one would have this hyperactivity piece and the other one didn't. And then now we're just saying ADHD with inattention or with impulsivity. So whatever, it's kind of the same thing. It kind of splitting hairs on that. But what Len Koziel had said is, you know, if we're going to rewrite the phrasing again, the terminology, we should rewrite it to say it's an intention disorder. You intend to do something, but reflexively you do something else. If you're sitting at a stoplight and you're waiting for the light to change, you're primed, you know, waiting for the green light, but that little green arrow in the corner of your eye for the turn lane flashes green, and you have that moment where you leap, where you kind of lose, we'll say, self-control. that's an intention disorder. You don't intend on going, but you go anyway. That is kind of one of these hallmarks of ADHD, as Len would define it. I told that story real quick. I told that story to a gentleman once, and he said, "Yeah, you know what? I got into 3 car accidents doing that. I leapt, you know, I leaped when I didn't mean to leap, and I've smashed my car 3 times." And so that's an intention disorder. He didn't intend on smashing his car, but he lost the self-control. So, you know, back to the bottom of this, that ADHD has typically 2 parts, just like Skip's analogy with the swinging saloon doors, that it's, can I bring my attention to where I want it to, and can I stop all the other incoming stuff and all the other options of my behavior when I need to? So it's a combination of 2 things happening at once, for sure.
So if the DSM manual, mm-hmm. it is what's been used for a long time, and it kind of paints a broad brush, puts labels on people. In our field, what would you use to get objective data to get a better diagnosis?
Well, I think that's a pretty good segue to neurofeedback and to Bob Thatcher's gift to us with this neuro guide. Is I have folks come in and I use the brain mappings, or the Qs, the QEEGs, quantitative EEGs, as a supplement to the neuropsych testing, because it'll actually show, as you've referred to or alluded to, Pete, different areas of the brain and the colorations, which lets you know what kind of activity or inactivity is occurring there. And now we're able to have conversations with folks about, you know, I'll put it simply, but what's working, what's not working, which immediately lends itself to treatment, versus here's all these things and we're going to call it this, and it's going to get treated as if this, it's this label. So again, back to the idea that we can now literally see things that allow us to have a better understanding neuroanatomically what's going on. And now we're at the source. Now we're at the issue. You know, root cause is a phrase that's thrown around a lot, but now we're there, at least up in the brain, right? And as Laura was mentioning before, there's all kinds of other systems that are involved in what the brain does. And very currently, the gut, which is, you know, from the mouth all the way through, so it's not just your tummy, you know, is referred to as the second brain. And there's more neurons in the gut than there are in the brain. And there's more neural pathways going from the gut to the brain than the brain to the gut. So that means the gut's talking to the brain more than the brain's talking to the gut. So what does all that mean? It means that there's more to the picture than we think. And it's more to the story than Johnny or Janie just not listening to what we're telling them, right? There's a lot of factors going on here. And I think that might be podcast 2 or 3, you know, with other factors that influence how the entire physiology works towards basically performing. And performing is just whatever you need to do in your day. And sometimes it means sit down in class, or, you know, stop chewing with your mouth open at dinner, you know, like whatever it might entail. But anyway, there's a lot of factors that are.
Skip, yes. I know that's, you know, we probably really should have another podcast to talk only about that. But since we're kind of talking about anxiety and COVID, and can you give us a hint, or not a hint, but a, you know, a couple examples of how, you know, gut health and COVID lockdowns and, you know, learning might play together?
Sure, I can. Yeah, sure.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, at least, you know, touch on it. So there's a field of medicine that's referred to as functional medicine. And so functional medicine is concerned with the entirety of how a particular organism is functioning, right? And in this case, we're talking about us, you know, humans. And so real quick, traditional Western medicine is symptom driven. And so you have a runny nose and you're given an antihistamine to stop the nose from running. Functional medicine will look at that system. Why are there histamines being produced? Is the system broken or faulty? Is there something in the environment that is triggering the system to do what it's supposed to do, right? Kick out histamines if that's the case. And so again, it's looking at contributions to a behavior. And so when you do that, you're taking more of a holistic approach. What that entails is this idea of gut health. And what's, again, been known for a good 20 years or so, but it's just becoming more prominent and prevalent in the research as, again, our technology advances and we can just see more, is that gut health is instrumental in overall cognitive functioning. And it does involve what I mentioned or alluded to just real quickly a minute ago. And that's the idea that the gut's talking to the brain. And that's a simple way to put it. But that gut health is instrumental in overall functioning, but they're finding that it's involved in a lot of neurodegenerative diseases, which we're here talking about anxiety for kids, but I'm referring to dementias, I'm referring to Parkinson's, I'm referring to those kinds of disorders that are, you know, quote, old folks things, but they start in our 20s and 30s. The latest research and findings or conclusions about what to do with dementias is preventative type lifestyles starting in your 20s and 30s. And so my point in that is that it's this entire system that involves gut health, because what ultimately happens, and I know I'm, you know, simplifying things like crazy here, is that through gut dis-health or dis-ease, you develop what's called a leaky gut. And so now you have toxins that are supposed to be in your gut and be processed through your gut leaking into your bloodstream. And then they're able to travel north and get through the blood-brain barrier and affect neurological functioning, but also affect neurological structures. Right. So there's a deterioration that happens over time. And also back to Laura's vagal nerve example, with a leaky gut, just to pick an issue that's involved in this kind of functional medicine way of looking at things, or just gut health in general, is that there's also often inflammation. And I don't mean, you know, like you bang your toe inflammation, even though it's the same thing, just in a different direction, but inflammation in the way that it's inhibiting these communication patterns. So over time, you're also getting a diminished communication efficiency, if that makes sense to you. But also what's happening is that you're creating an environment that there's increased adrenaline and cortisol, right? And those are good guys when you're getting chased by the saber-toothed tiger. They're not good guys when you have to stay inside for 6 months because there's COVID and you're living in the Chicago suburbs and you just gotta, you know, now do your homework over Zoom. Right? It's a system that's in place because we evolutionarily need it. We've also now find ourselves in an environment where we're constantly alerted by things, and this system is getting flipped on too much. And so it's contributing. I don't want to say it's creating. It's contributing to these imbalances, as I've been referring to, that over time lead to things that we can call anxiety. But when you kind of start checking it out a little bit more under the hood, as you say, Laura, we're seeing that there's other issues here. There's other issues that can be dealt with and that should be dealt with, as opposed to just treating, you know, anxiety, right? So again, go ahead, sorry.
No, it's great. So let me kind of bring it back home. We can come full circle on this conversation. Yes, we're talking about children, and you know, certainly it's the topic, you know, right now is COVID and you know, where are things going and the fears, et cetera. But when we're, and this is, you know, getting, you know, kind of specific, but I think we should open this conversation that, again, our limbic system is our memory in our fear system. And we could also, you know, talk about our reward system, what motivates us and, you know, arouses us to do what we need to do. So there's all sorts of branches of this limbic system, but it's memory, which has to do with learning, right? And has to do, and sorry for the too much information, too much neuroscience here, but there's a cholinergic function involved here. And the reason I say cholinergic, because that helps with memory. And as we're talking about children trying to learn from Zoom and all that stuff, it, you know, Skip brought up neurodegenerative disease. You start talking about Alzheimer's. These are the exact same pathways and chemicals involved or that are dysregulated when we start talking about dementias and Alzheimer's. So we're talking about child development. And, you know, I don't want to be too gloom and doom here and draw a straight line here. But you know, if you have, you know, fight or flight, you know, trauma experiences and, you know, the gut health issues, and they do circle back with the vagal nerve, you know, to brain functioning. And again, we're wrapping in memory, we're wrapping in learning, you know, ultimately, you know, what percentage of these, and me and Skip were talking about this yesterday, you know, what percentage did you say people in our age group are, might end up with dementia, Skip?
Half.
Okay. Yep. So half of the folks in our age group, I mean, you know, it's worth repeating, can end up with dementia.
By the time they reach their 80s. So by the time we're on, everyone on this call is in the 80s.
Right.
Here one and a half of us.
We'll still hear it, right?
Yes.
So the point being is that we have these physical brain structures. We have the research domain criteria, which is going to be the next phase, you know, when the DSM gets phased out. We have these, that's a body of science that tries to objectify trying to make diagnosis. So we can look, we have the equipment, we could take these pictures, but the point is we have these brain structures and these chemicals that are not acting properly when we're under trauma and anxiety. And yes, as children, you know, we're you know, struggling with learning the appropriate things and what kind of jobs are we going to get if we don't learn properly, et cetera. But we're also talking about, yeah, boy, you know, would this, in this hypothetically, and, you know, there's got to be some validity in here somewhere, you know, what is this going to turn into down the road in terms of, you know, are you going to be developing or be more susceptible to dementias? And, you know, it's something worth, you know, keeping our eyes open for.
So guys, the moms and dads out there, they're kind of wondering, oh man, does my kid have anxiety, ADHD, whatever the issue is. How can they quickly get some objective data to figure out what's going on with our services?
I'll grab that. Yeah. So, you know, again, we're talking about objectivity. We have the equipment, the technology, as Skip said, these days we can, you know, have this little amplifier that can amplify electrical signals that emit from your brain, a millionth of a volt, or these little microvolts coming out of our brain because we're producing energy. We have power, you know, our lights are on. And so we're gonna have some power coming off our scalp, emanating from the brain. And we can put a nylon cap on someone's head. There's little sensors in the cap with some conductive gel. We can put a little saline solution basically into the cap on these sensors, read the electrical energy coming from your brain, transform it, into patterns and pictures, and based on, you know, what areas of the brain are doing what, you know, what areas are working too hard, what areas are not working hard enough, we can get a, as Pete calls it, a heat map. We could, you know, find out what's out of bounds, what's not expected to be functioning the way it's functioning, and gives us you know, clues on kind of what's going on. We match up these objective maps to people's you know, symptoms that they're telling us about. And you know, we have people do checklists and try to monitor how they're, you know, seeing themselves and, you know, match it up to these brain patterns on these pictures. And then we develop treatment plans. We can, you know, find out if the amygdala is working too much. We can find out if these, you know, memory and learning centers and emotional fight or flight systems that are connected, are they, you know, overactive or are they underactive? And if they are, then yeah, we do have neurofeedback services to help people help themselves. The brain can get feedback on how they're performing in these brain regions and train themselves by, and you know, there's, we could talk about this, you know, and we have another podcast, but the procedure for neurofeedback is you can basically sit in a lazy boy chair. We can have you pick out a movie or on Netflix, and you can get reward-based learning to help regulate those areas of the brain that are dysregulated. So basically the reward is the movie plays when your brain regions are functioning properly, and you get no reward when they're not, you know, when they're out of bounds. So this repetitive learning translates to having that brain area function properly. You repeat it enough times and the training will say sticks. And then we're expecting to see, you know, change in symptoms as a result of these kinds of trainings. So yeah, we can help people with learning, with anxiety and all the other things we were talking about today, including dementia. with neurofeedback.
I'm not a doc, I'm a dad, and it's just fascinating when you see these kids coming in, bouncing all over the place. They hop in that chair, you put on the Netflix, and they're leaning forward, eyes glued to the screen. Their hands folded for 20 minutes. It's just, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. Guys, I think that wraps up our time. Dr. Skip, thank you so much for coming on. How can people get some more information on your services? What's your website? How do they get a hold of you?
Well, again, thanks again for having me on, Pete. So there's that. And then if folks want to reach out, drskiphrin.com. So Dr. Skiprin, that's me. That's my website, and it has my contact information on there. I do have a private practice in Alaska. So if you're ever in the neighborhood and want to talk to me, give me a call. But also because of our telemedicine trend here, I can talk to anybody just about anywhere over Zoom.
Dr. Skip, you're chilling in Alaska. You're going to be chilling soon. Dr. Laura, how can people get a hold of you outside of NeuroNoodle?
Let's see. How about the website's a long address. Oh, you know what? We shortened it. Janssons, JANSONS.com. JANSONS.com. And that'll forward you to my website. And yeah, we have a practice here in Arlington Heights, Illinois, and we're connected with you out in Vernon Hills, Illinois, and we're moving to Buffalo Grove. And just like Skip said, yeah, we're allowed to do things remotely. I'll speak for myself, Skip, but I've purchased a travel trailer, and who knows where the next podcast will be from. Maybe Jupiter, Florida, who knows?
All right.
That's outstanding, guys. And I'm Pete Janssens at NeuroNoodle. Get a doodle of your noodle. Guys, take care.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida, led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Hours now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now. Join us at the 7th Annual Super Brain Summit at Bradley University Center for Collaborative Brain Research. It's featuring speaker Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor. She's the author of The Grieving Brain, a surprising science of how we learn from our love and loss. If you want to get more information regarding registration, contact Gwen Howarter. She's at ghowarter@bradley.edu or call her at 309-677-3900. If you want more information regarding programming, you can contact Dr. Lori Russell Chapin herself at 309-677-3186 or email lar@bradley.edu.